Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Afghanistan and America's role in it. We're fortunate to have as our guest Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of 6 books, but most recently, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Douglas, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. If you would like to join this conversation, please do so by calling 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'm going to start a little bit. I should say at the beginning, I liked your book, enjoyed reading it, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but to some degree, it felt like an old story. In that I've read this before about Vietnam. I've read this before about other conflicts. In some ways, it's a story of I'll let you characterize it, but to me, it read like a story of arrogance and carelessness in an area that we did not understand well and really didn't. Is that what you set out to demonstrate?
Well, arrogance and hubris are us. Yeah, we did it in Vietnam, and we are sure doing it in Afghanistan. I was embedded with U.S. troops in Afghanistan starting in 2009, returned, and then just got back from another series of embeds in Afghanistan in mid-February. I was in the war zones of eastern and southern Afghanistan, embedded with U.S. troops, and then spent a fair amount of time in Kabul interviewing a broad range of Afghans and U.S. officials there. And I think the story that is ongoing, the one that I think you're referencing, is that the soldiers, when I was out there, began telling me that the U.S. government is wasting tens of billions of American taxpayer dollars each year on scandalously mismanaged aid and logistics contracts. And we'd be out in Taliban country, in Indian country, as the soldiers refer to it. We'd be in these convoys of armored vehicles, and, everyone's heavily armed, and we're rolling along in these kind of rolling bank vaults. And I'm not heavily armed, but they are. They would be telling me that there was a toxic system that was connecting distracted American officials, careerists, private U.S. corporations, corrupt Afghan officials, and the Taliban. We'd be rolling along, and they would be telling me that we're funding our own enemy. We're financing both sides of this war. And at first, it seemed really preposterous to me that American taxpayers were literally funding the Taliban. But as I began asking about it out in the war zone, American officials and American military officers basically confirmed that was the case, not very readily, but they were confirming that was the case. And when I got back, I started digging into just a mountain of government reports and think tank white papers and media reports and interviewing hundreds of people from security grunts on the ground, development officers, diplomats, ambassadors, generals, a whole broad range of people. And that is the story. That's what led to the book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban.
Well, and I should jump in. It's about more than just simply the dollars going errant.
It is about a failed system.
Yeah, it's a book you talk about in some ways how, the money that we've pumped into Afghanistan has revitalized drug trade in the region and throughout the world, that it's created an institutionalized system of corruption in the Afghan government. If I can take you back, and I probably should take a pause here and just remind our listeners they can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. But if I can take you back, was there a moment that this thing started to jump off the rails, one sort of decisive decision that started us down the wrong path?
Well, there were a number of junctures that brought us to this point. One of the first was our decision to basically ally with Afghan warlords who were essentially drug lords to do the war on the cheap, to do the invasion after 9/11 in 2001. And we allied ourselves with some really naughty people, and we have continued to maintain those alliances. Afghanistan this year was ranked as the most corrupt government on the planet. It's tied with Somalia and North Korea. It's sixth on the failed state list. This is after 12 years after our invasion. And we facilitated a culture of corruption. I mean, it is a Central Asian country, and bakshish is part of the culture, but there's never been anything like this. I've done a lot of inquiry into that question, and there, corruption has never been at this level of massive kleptocracy.
Well, you talk about in the book, I mean, even things like teachers saying you've got to pay a bribe to get your child the lessons for the day, right down to that level, that the roots of the corruption are so deep. Is there anything at this stage that can be done about that?
I'm a journalist. I have to report what people tell me. Mm-hmm. And the story that I hear time and time again is that this system, this toxic system that I discussed, is so deeply rooted that it's really hard to change it at this point. I went out in this last series of embeds with what I thought was an open mind. I wanted to know what had changed since I had last been there. The military has a great phrase, lessons learned. What are the lessons learned? So you can run around in embassies and in command centers and say, what are the lessons learned here? And people stand up straight and report. And I would ask that question expecting major policy shifts. And, well, we're doing this. This was how money was leaching to the insurgents. This is how money was being wasted. But this is what we're doing now. And instead, I felt like people were pointing at the sky saying, look, wild geese. Just nothing. I didn't see any changes. There are some of the most scandalously unsupervised funds. Those have been shut down, something called SERP funds, Commander's Emergency Response Program, that dates to Iraq. That program has been dialed down quite a bit. That was wildly out of control. But other than that, the same incredibly wasteful programs, our contracts are continuing to be let, even though things are not going well and we're headed out the door.
We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Douglas, we've sort of given the broad overview here of what the book is about. I'd like to talk a little bit about the path that led you to want to go to Afghanistan. You're an independent journalist, right? So in some ways you get to be your own assignment editor, which is a nice role to be in. Why Afghanistan? You know, much of, as you point out in the book, much of America's energy and attention shifted to Iraq when we moved in there, and Afghanistan in many ways became kind of the forgotten war. What prompted you to decide Afghanistan was the place you wanted to go to?
Well, I've had a long focus on Central Asia. Many people know that Indiana University is one of the centers of Central Asian studies in the country. So you'll be in the back country on the far side of nowhere, and you run across another Westerner, and they'll ask where you're from, and I say Bloomington, Indiana, and they go, oh, yeah, I was there, because they were taking Urdu or Pashto or, you know, something. So whether they're CIA agents or diplomats or the whole broad range of characters that show up in Central Asia, and a remarkable coincidence, many of them have come through Bloomington or know people in Bloomington. So for many, many years, I've had a real interest in Central Asia and have traveled through a good part of it, particularly through the Himalayas. I had a real focus on Tibet for a long time, wrote a book called Pioneer in Tibet about a man from Indiana who was a famous explorer of Tibet and really introduced Tibet to the United States early in the 20th century. And so I've traveled from one end of Tibet to the other in pretty silly ways. And my interest in Afghanistan really relates to, I had spent time in the Pashtun regions, the tribal regions, pre-9/11. And I had been working with one warrior tribe in Tibet, the Khampas, who are a famous warrior tribe. And the Pashtuns, who are the Taliban, who are the insurgents, have another warrior culture. And I was drawn to this, you know, the kind of the poetry and the cultural underpinnings that form a warrior society, like our Scotch-Irish, like the Sioux, like, you know, many, many of warrior societies have things in common. So I had spent time there and I'm fascinated by Central Asia, is the short answer. And I had been in Mexico in 2009 and was standing on a street corner reading the Herald Tribune, which I managed to find a copy of somewhere. And I read this article about agribusiness development teams, a Texas agribusiness development team that were working in Afghanistan. And the Texas agribusiness development team was a group of farmer soldiers. And they were National Guard soldiers. And they were going out in these small teams, elite teams, and trying to do development work in an active war zone. They had their own security teams as well as agricultural specialists. And I'm reading this thinking that's kind of interesting. And then they talk about the project that they want to do, which was either an 8,000-acre wheat seed farm at 11,000 feet or an 11,000, you know, acre wheat seed farm at 8,000 acres or 8,000 feet. I can't recall which it was. At any rate, from my work in Tibet, I understood immediately you can't grow wheat that high. Mm-hmm. And they had these plans to airlift in Great Plains style combines and this crazy thing. Their literacy rate in those areas is about 8%, 10%. So what are you going to, you know, there's no way to sustain this. I'm thinking this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And I shoved the article in my briefcase, got back home. About a month later, found the article. And I had noted that there was an Indiana team that was also one of these agribusiness development teams. And I thought, well, I'm going to track this down because this will be a funny story. And, you know, and I called somebody at Camp Atterbury and they said, well, if you want to talk to them, you have to come now or tomorrow morning because they're leaving for Afghanistan. So I went over there really thinking I was going to be, you know, having this kind of silly conversation.
And we will pick up the story on the other side. We are talking with author Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. You are listening to No Limits. You can join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Just before the break, Douglas, you were talking about the it sounds like the rather circuitous path that led you back to Afghanistan, primarily because you discovered that some plans to do kind of an agricultural grafting there made little or no sense.
Well, I discovered that there was an Indiana National Guard agribusiness development team, a group of farmer soldiers, and I went to visit with them just before they left for Afghanistan. And I had read about these other teams that did not have good plans, and I was anticipating the same kind of thing. What I discovered when I started interviewing the command team was that the Indiana team had done a lot of cultural training at Indiana University. Some of the folks spoke some rudimentary Pashto. They had gone up to Purdue that also has an agricultural project focused on Afghanistan. They had prepared themselves to do Afghan-appropriate agriculture up there. And I was sitting around getting more and more impressed with this group of people. And finally, I gave them the big question, you know, well, what kind of projects are you going to do in Afghanistan? And they looked at me and they said, well, we don't know. We're going to ask the Afghans when we get there. And I sort of blurted out, well, I would go with you and cover this. And that's how I got to Afghanistan, too. The team had picked out a province on the eastern border of Afghanistan, they later told me, which abuts the Pakistan's tribal region, effectively Taliban-controlled tribal region. And they said they had looked at a map, and it was green. And the farmer soldiers said, well, we can work with that. What they didn't know was the most violent province in Afghanistan at the time.
We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. You can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. So that's what brought you back to Afghanistan. When you got over there, you'd mentioned that there were conversations from American service people and people who were working over there telling you about the culture of corruption. When did you begin to think, okay, there's a book here?
You know, I'm going to read a little section out of the book. You know, when you're a writer, it's always great when you just get to read. I feel like I can tell you when that did indeed happen. It was on my second trip when I was really focused on this issue of what the military calls threat funding. How does the Taliban finance itself? And increasingly, it was obvious they were financing it with funds extorted and skimmed from, Americans may be unaware, we've spent well over $600 billion there. The total bill is going to be way over $1 trillion. We're still today, as we're leaving, spending between $1.5 million to $2 billion each week in Afghanistan on essentially wasted projects.
How many trips before you start reading? You mentioned on your first trip. How many trips have you made to Afghanistan?
Well, this last time would have been my fourth.
Your fourth, okay.
I was on a base called Forward Operating Base Meterlam in a wild province called Lagman Province, also in eastern Afghanistan. And it had been a wild couple of days. There had been attacks everywhere in the province, IEDs going off, things blowing up. The rapid response teams were having to go out all the time. The artillery was just going off all night. And everybody was pretty ragged. It was a small base. And it was early in the morning. I was standing on the porch of a little plywood hut. They're called bee huts. And they're like tens of thousands of them everywhere that the military industrial complex has thrown up all over Afghanistan. And I was standing there with an intelligence officer, a man by the name of Captain Douglas Seymour. He was a big, lantern-jawed guy. He had been, in his civilian life, had been a narcotics cop, a detective in Las Vegas. And
that must have created some dissonance for him when he's over there.
Well, amazingly enough, not. And he knew I was a journalist. I mean, everybody, you announce who you are, and everybody who didn't know knows pretty quickly. And so we're standing out there, and he looked pretty rough. And he started talking to me, and he said he started comparing Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan, to Las Vegas. He said everybody was getting their cut. There was just enough excitement to keep the rubes engaged. He noted that American casualties over 8 years of war in Afghanistan were below the number killed in military training. Captain Seymour said to me, he said, the Afghans know just the right amount of fighting to keep us here. Not too many casualties or we'll bolt. Can't let peace break out or we'll lose interest. Just the right amount. And then he talked in this jaded GI voice that I'd heard so much by that point. He said, you know, everybody's winning. This is a quote. He said, the military, they get all these combat commands and combat patches. I get all this cool equipment. I started back when the Russians were the enemy. I never got all this cool equipment. The military industrial complex, they're all making money, all this stuff. And he points back at this little plywood hut that starts delaminating almost before the last nail is driven. He said, what's that cost? $28,000. It's a playhouse. The government here, they're like the mafia, always getting their cut. The Taliban get their cut. It's the perfect war. Everybody makes money. And that's probably the moment I thought, there's a book here.
There's a book. You just came back from Afghanistan in mid-February from your latest embed with Indiana National Guardsmen.
And other units. Yeah.
And we care mostly about Indiana
sure,
here.
Yeah.
Understandably, we're talking to an Indiana audience. I would think that that would be incredibly discouraging if you were a service person over there right now. What is the mood of those guardsmen that you were embedded with?
Well, I have to say people are really doing their job. It's very impressive. I mean, as a Hoosier, as an American, people are keeping it packed together, which is really to their credit. But I'm going to read another little section from the book. I talked to a Marine officer. The Marines have a battle space command down in southern Afghanistan, and he said some things that really resonated to what I had been hearing. He said, among the Marines in Afghanistan, there's low morale. They say this is such a waste of time. This is a drug and tribal war with the Pakistani and Iranian intelligence agencies involved. These people will never pull their heads out of their, you know, Marine talk.
Yeah. Thank you for editing.
On an operational level, the soldiers are saying, I'm going to go over there and try to not get my legs blown off. My nation will shut this down. That's the feeling of my fellow soldiers. And the Marine officer, he said, the juice ain't worth the squeeze. And I'd heard that a lot. The juice ain't worth the squeeze.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Carly. And if you want to take part in this conversation, please do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter, as Carly did, at WFYI. It says, Douglas, can you talk about the waste on reconstruction in the Middle East? How has reconstruction impacted Afghanistan positively and negatively?
Well, I think one of the biggest surprises I had when I was starting work on this book and a shift in my own thinking from the time I went out, counterinsurgency, as we think about it in this post 9/11 period, and even going back to Vietnam, includes a large component of development and aid. The theory is that helping people earn more money and have better infrastructure and those kinds of things improves security, improves our security. And that's the way foreign aid development has been sold to the Congress, been sold to the American public. What I have learned is there is literally no documentation that links development and aid to an increase in security. And if anything, there is more studies that seem to indicate there's no correlation at all. In some cases, more development actually increases insecurity.
Well, and in some ways, if there's a thesis to your book, it's that the money that got funneled in there came back to haunt us in several different ways. The fact that the title of the book is Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban, is a little bit of a clue as to that. Who are... I'm trying to think of a proper term, journalistically. Well, I'll go with it. Who are the villains in this piece? I mean, who are the people who set us on the wrong course?
I can tell you who they're not.
Okay.
It's not the guys on the ground. Mm-hmm. The men and women on the ground. They're doing their job. And... I'm looking through my notes here. There's a wonderful quote from Secretary of Defense Gates who talks about whatever problems there were. Here we go. Whatever shortcomings, this is Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. He said this in 2010. He said, whatever shortcomings there may have been in Iraq and Afghanistan stemmed from failures and miscalculations at the top, not those doing the fighting and leading on the ground. It has taken every ounce of our troops, skill, initiative, and commitment to battle a cunning and adaptive enemy at the front while overcoming bureaucratic lassitude and sometimes worse at the rear. So I think I have witnessed our soldiers really doing the best they can. They've been given a lousy mission.
Yeah. How did they react? You know, once this book began to take shape for you, and you realized you were going to do a book about really how no other way to say it, we were shooting ourselves in the foot in many ways. How did they respond when you sort of laid out what you wanted to talk about? Were they eager to tell their stories? Were they reluctant? Were they?
Most people wanted to tell their story. They would. There's like what's told in front of the curtain, what's told behind the curtain. What's the line that you're supposed to say? Then what's the truth? There's a lieutenant colonel named Daniel Davis who became somewhat famous not too long ago for coming out with a major report talking about what he termed the truth deficit. There is an extraordinary divergence between what is told from the podiums in Washington and the Pentagon and in Kabul and the ground reality, the ground truth in Afghanistan. And what I found was the soldiers wanted to talk about what was the truth, what was really going on. And, you know, everybody's kind of scrambling now to get out, to put the best face on things. They don't want their brass to be tarnished. They don't want their careers to, you know, everybody's been punching their ticket there. This has been a great gig for the State Department, for the military.
Great gig in what way? Because of the money or because?
Money's great. It's a way you punch your ticket to move up in the bureaucracy. It's a careerist nightmare. And people are there on very short rotations. I mean, that's been one of the major problems. There's been no institutional memory. When I was out there this time, people would be proudly telling me about a new program or a new thing they were going to be doing. And I'd be thinking, my God, this didn't work 2 years ago. Everybody knew this. In one case, I was in one province called Zabul. They were building a new slaughterhouse, and I knew there had been an absolute failed slaughterhouse project 3 years before, and they had lost track of it. And it was failing again. And they're like going, oh, my God. And the dollar figures on these things, because it's going through what are called the Beltway Bandits, these for-profit development companies, the money that goes for this stuff, Americans would be stunned by. You can't imagine how much it costs. I can tell you about a project that I think is emblematic of how this works, which is the Host Guardes Highway, if we have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a somewhat infamous highway in eastern Afghanistan called the Host Guardes Highway, which essentially goes from nowhere to nowhere. It's a 64-mile-long road, a little skinny two-lane that goes through the mountains, actually going on a roadbed the Germans had put in the 60s. When I last checked on it, this thing was costing somewhere around $200 million, which is $2.8 million a mile. It was 176, but it's gone over that. At the point, it was $2.8 million a mile, which is more than it costs to do a road here.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember, in Afghanistan, Afghans make about $400 a year. So it's dimes on the hour for labor. So the way this works, the way the money ends up flowing over into the Taliban coffers is generally through the security contracts. So we're trying to do development in a war zone. Security is a major part of it. Typically 25 to 40% of the total contract goes to security. The contract went to two American companies that are the ultimate Beltway Bandits, the Lewis Burger Group and Black & Veatch. And the security component, the major security firms are typically controlled by powerful Afghan families, politically connected Afghan insider families. And they, of course, don't touch anything with security. They just take their cut and subcontract it off to somebody. So in this particular case, the host guard has highway, $43 million of the $176 went for security. It got subcontracted and subcontracted. It just everybody peels off money and mm-hmm. takes their part, passes it off to somebody else. Finally got down to the person doing security on the ground. This is a totally insecure area, essentially Taliban-controlled. It's the Haqqani network and another insurgent group. Well, we ended up hiring a known insurgent leader to provide security against himself. We paid him $160,000 a month to provide security against himself. This individual was on our killer capture list, the special mm-hmm. ops killer capture list, the JPEL list. That was the go-to guy we hired to provide security.
We are talking about Afghanistan with Douglas A. Wissing, the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Obviously, there's a profit motive for people not to acknowledge wrongdoing, but I'm also remembering, I think it was in one of the presidential debates in 2004 when President George W. Bush was responding to something John Kerry had said, and he said, how do you tell a service person that he died, or the family of one, that he died for a mistake? Is there some of that, too, that we couldn't acknowledge that maybe we made a wrong decision going in?
Yeah, there is a case that just happened, a tragic case. There was a young diplomat with whom I worked when I was in Kabul just recently, a woman named Anne Smedinghoff. Anne was a very ambitious young State Department diplomat. She was in the Kabul embassy, and she facilitated some meetings that I wanted to have with particular cells of individuals working on projects. And had come from Johns Hopkins, and essentially...
We'll finish the story after the break. You are listening to No Limits. We're talking with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Before we went to the break, Douglas, you were talking about the human side, really, of the conflict and human losses.
Yeah, we were talking about... the debate between George Bush and the candidate, John Kerry, about the reasons for this sustained conflict. And you had pointed out that some of it has to do with not needing to sustain the reason for the people who lost their lives there.
To justify in some way.
To justify,
the expense of life.
And I was speaking about a young diplomat I met when I was in Kabul, in February and January, named Anne Smedinghoff, who just lost her life in a very insecure province called Zabul, where I had been. And when I was with Anne in the embassy, and the embassy in Kabul is essentially a fortress now. Mm-hmm. It is really difficult to get in and out of. It's right in the center of Kabul. Kabul is a very unsafe place. And so Anne was chafing at these restrictions where the diplomats can't leave the embassy. You can't go to a pizza place. You can't leave except in armored vehicles and whatnot. And Anne really wanted to go out. So she was very interested in what I was doing in Zabul and how did that go. She really wanted to go out. One of the last things she told me is sometimes the embassy, with all these really smart careerist people, it's like being on a small liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And some days it's like being in a maximum security prison. And Anne wanted out. Well, she got out. She got to Zabel, and she was blown up right at a spot where I had been, where it had taken me, it had taken 2 days for the military to organize a mission to go 2 miles in armored vehicles from one post to the other post. She was killed when she was, quotes, lost and out walking. Something had gone horribly wrong with security, operational security. And Secretary of State Kerry, she was a very smart person. She had taken care of his arrangements when he was recently in Kabul. He was touched by the story and got really engaged with it, and went to visit her parents who live in Chicago. And I found myself thinking about John Kerry when he was a young soldier, mm-hmm. famously talking to the Congress about who wants to be the last person who died in a bad war. And I'm really, Anne Smetinghoff was as bright a person as you could imagine.
We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Rev, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. The report is almost incomprehensible, and it begs a question, I think. We have all these soldiers, presumably not ignorant people, resentful, cynical, well-trained and with weapons and tactics, coming back to a country which may not support them the way they think they should be supported, and with the government, in spite of its wasting money overseas, has less and less money in this country for security. So the question is, do you think there's going to be a problem with the soldiers in terms of causing trouble or even insurrection? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Rev. Reentry, I think, basically, for a lot of these folks after an experience in this kind of culture of corruption.
I think that the American public, and as we ponder the real costs of these wars, which are the post-9/11 wars, which the last numbers I've seen are talking about $4 trillion of the total tax bill. And I've seen as high as $6 billion now, or $6 trillion, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I think we have to cope with the tidal wave of brain trauma injuries that are coming back, mm-hmm. and the tidal wave of PTSD. You have to understand this is a...
We probably ought to spell that out, post-traumatic stress.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The military love acronyms.
Yeah.
You get used to them.
Yeah.
It's a foreign language. And we're not really I've spoken to VA people who talk about the brain trauma injuries are a tidal wave that's threatening to overwhelm them. And it's an asymmetrical war where you can't really protect people from the pressure blast. And those things are just ubiquitous. There's IEDs everywhere. We just witnessed that in a very small way in Boston. And that's what people in Afghanistan have been living with for 30 years now.
We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, Lee. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just listening to your program here, and might be able to shed some light. I did four tours in the sandbox. I was in Pakistan training the Mujahideen when the Soviets were still there.
Love to hear your story.
You've been there.
Or your question.
I do. He was talking about the vets. I've been trying to get bounce me out of the Marine Corps after 16 years. I've been trying to get my VA benefits for the last six. Just got in front of a judge, and I asked the judge there why it was taking so long. He said, because they can. If they can last you out, they don't have to pay anything.
Well, thank you for the call, Lee. And how common is this situation, Douglas?
From what I'm hearing anecdotally, unfortunately, I don't think the ex-Marine is experiencing anything unique.
That's happening across the board to people who we send over there, put in harm's way. And
we've got some major obligations to people, and there's a bill to be paid. And as Americans ponder what we're continuing to spend, and the money that is in the pipeline that has not yet been contracted, but these agencies and departments are frantically scrambling to spend another $30 billion that we don't need to obligate, I think Americans need to ask some hard questions and to really talk to their congresspeople about this.
We are talking with Douglas A. Wissing, author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. We have gotten an email from a listener named Jeff. It says the U.S. has a long history of funding the Taliban. That actually was the first part of your book, the first chapter. So they did so during the Soviet invasion. The U.S. has helped ensure that poppy production escalates. All you have to do is look at heroin production since 9/11. Let's face it, there's a lot of money to be made. Point two is the U.S. is funding al-Qaeda groups in Syria. Am I right? The U.S. has played both sides for way too long. Let's deal with the question. Point two is the U.S. is funding al-Qaeda groups in Syria.
I have to say it's out of my lane.
Okay, so cannot confirm that. I think the larger thrust of Jeff's email or question, though, is this idea of there's a cost ultimately to these kinds of proxy wars that we fight, that we... You know, during when the Cold War was still live, we funneled money into the Taliban that ultimately came back to haunt us.
Well,
when we fought
with
them.
Wasn't the Taliban. The Taliban didn't emerge until after the Soviets left, that particular group.
The Mujahideen.
But we certainly did support the Mujahideen. And, and for Hoosiers, they might be interested. People have kind of forgotten those were the great holy warriors that we thought were great when they were fighting the Soviets. There were Mujahideen, a lot of them. That did recuperation here, that did, you know, that came here for hospitalization and whatnot. Osama bin Laden was in Indianapolis at one point. And when the Taliban took power...
When was bin Laden here in Indy?
Before 9/11.
Yes.
And I don't remember the exact... It was in the 90s at some point. When the Taliban took power in Afghanistan, delegations, Taliban government delegations, came through Indiana at least a couple of times.
We are talking about Afghanistan here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Omar, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to just make a comment on Doug Wissing doing all this research. I really appreciate it. He knows who I am. Just wanted to ask if he found any evidence of corruption at the level of Afghani soldiers and commanders. I heard a story first, I guess a friend that I have met that was working with the U.S. government. They're doing some consulting work, and they discovered that someone in the military was basically allowing their soldiers to go on furlough for a really long period of time in exchange for, you know, one third or one half of their pay. And there were millions and millions of dollars being just squandered on there. And I suspect all that comes from the U.S. government. Did you find anything like that in Afghanistan?
Good question. Thank you very much, Omar. Douglas.
All those stories are rife in Afghanistan, ghost soldiers, the level of desertions and AWOLs. It's like a third of the Afghan army is gone at any given time. We have to basically the recruitment efforts are outstripped by desertions and AWOLs. And then there's whole parts of the army and the Afghan National Security Forces include the army, the police who have a paramilitary aspect, the border police, all those are, you know, there's a whole group that are part of security forces. It's rampant that money is being, it's a totally corrupt government. And so, yeah, the money comes from us. We're 97% of the Afghan gross domestic product is foreign aid. 97%.
97%. And how much of that comes from us?
Hold up your hand. Okay. You are a donor.
But I guess of that 97%, are we, you know,
a lot.
95, 96, not quite that much, but.
A major part.
Probably 9/10 of it?
I would be venturing.
Okay. We've also gotten a tweet from a listener named Ron who says, what keeps bringing you back to Afghanistan, and what draws you in about the country?
Well, I earlier confessed a love for Central Asia, and who knows how these things happen, but I have that. And it's an extraordinary place, and the Afghan people are really amazing people. They're strong and resilient, and the Pashtuns have a 1,000-year-old culture, and poetry is a major part of the Pashtun culture. These are warriors and poets. And Rumi, the famous Persian poet, he was born in northern Afghanistan. He's the best-selling poet in the United States, 13th-century poet. And when I was in Kabul, I would find myself walking around in these very dangerous neighborhoods with young Afghan men who wanted to talk about Rumi. You're in a war zone, and they want to talk about poetry. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is that. Part of it is I'm an American. This is a big American story. This is the amount of money we're spending there, the $1 trillion. Soldiers keep talking about. I remember one guy who was from Paoli, Indiana, and he was talking about being in charge of putting in a pretty simple orchard that was just going to cost tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, crazy amounts of money. Everything there costs crazy amounts of money. And he turned to me and he said, "My kids don't have books in their school. They can't afford books in that school." And this is connected to that. And I think Americans have to ask, you know, we think we're doing a good thing. There is a term called phantom aid. About 90% of development and aid dollars gets wasted. It goes to the overhead of these beltway bandits, you know, to overhead and to things of that nature. Only about 10% actually gets to the intended use. Phantom aid is a term that's used. And it's not unique to Afghanistan. That's the way it works around the world.
Your book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban, is a fairly savage indictment of the way the war has been conducted, and at least what's the reaction been from elected officials, or have you gotten any feedback?
Well, you have to.
And I know Lee Hamilton endorsed it, but yeah,
we're lucky to have
Lee
Hamilton as our representative, a retired representative now, but still a very active man. Well, I confess I was pretty nervous going back to Afghanistan because I am dependent on the military for security. You move around in the war zone by essentially hitching rides with some pretty scary characters. That's the way you get around. And obviously the military knew about my book and my other writings, and it was complicated to get approvals to go back in. It went back and forth a number of times, but essentially all of the major battle zone owners eventually did agree to let me come and embed in their battle spaces. And sometimes it was kind of funny. I'd be walking down a hallway in a headquarters and somebody would stick their head out and go, come in here for a second. Mm-hmm. They'd pull a book out of the drawer and say, "Would you sign this for me?" Nobody has rebutted it. That's the part that's really amazing to me.
Is nobody's responded in any way. We've got just a little bit of time left, like a couple of minutes. What lessons should we draw as a country from our experience in Afghanistan? I mean, I guess if not, it'll be an expensive lesson from what you've said here, not just in terms of treasure, but also in human costs, both Americans and Afghans. What lessons should we draw from this?
Well, you can't buy a victory. And the way that we're waging war, the privatization of war, our career structure, where people are just punching their tickets, our use of these private development corporations, we're not accomplishing our goals. We're spending the money. I mean, just to summarize again, Afghanistan, after 12 years of war, is ranked as the most corrupt government on the planet. It is sixth on the failed state list. The Taliban has grown in strength each year we have been there, most of the time by double digits. And the special ops dictum always has been, if an insurgency isn't shrinking, it's winning. We have done this with a total hack bill of about $1 trillion. Tens of thousands of Afghan and American lives have been lost. And as the soldiers tell me, the juice ain't worth the squeeze.
Are you planning to go back to Afghanistan, or are you done now and moving on to your next chapter?
I confess I'm going to be working on another book, a follow-up book to this, not like this. I don't need to prove this case anymore. It's more about an experiential journey through America's endgame in Afghanistan.
Almost like a memoir of your experiences, or
yeah,
a little
I
bit like
so.
That?
Yeah, and I'm also fascinated by, there's a group called the Dutch Committee for Afghanistan that has been training paravets since the 80s, and they do it very inexpensively and basically do it in a very Afghan-appropriate way.
When do you plan on going back?
They would like for me to go back and spend time in the villages in the summer, and I'm debating whether I do that or not.
We have been talking with Douglas A. Wissing, who is the author of Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban, about his experiences in Afghanistan and about how so much American tax money, frankly, has helped to foster a culture of corruption. Douglas, thank you very much for spending this time with us. It has been a fascinating conversation. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. It's been great to be on the show.
We will be back next week. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.